Well, thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here again. Thank you for inviting me. I just wanted to, it'll become clear why this picture exists, hopefully. I'll be talking about geometrical frustration in solids. And one of the pervasive themes in physics is to try to understand nature from simple two-body interactions. And in solids that we use that paradigm over and over again. We try to understand, for instance, the behavior of a magnet in terms of a simple interaction between two atomic spins on a regular lattice, where the strength of the coupling of those spins determines the collective properties of the material, And so this is what we always try to do. It makes life easy. But there's a class of physical phenomena ranging from turbulence in fluids to the Kondo problem of single spins in metallic hosts to elementary particle physics, which can't be described by a single parameter. Where you need to describe matter at all length scales simultaneously. And the example that's relevant for this talk is that of critical phenomena at phase transitions. Here I show some physical properties, specific heat, magnetization, and correlation length, and how they diverge in the vicinity of a transition from disordered material, say paramagnetic material, to ordered ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic material. In this critical region, the correlations on all length scales need to be considered, and one of the reasons this is such an important topic is that the behavior of critical phenomena seems to be independent of the type of material, rather depending mainly on the spatial dimensionality and the dimensionality of the fundamental degree of freedom. And so there a set of equations describes the behavior to extremely high accuracy in this critical region, no matter if one's talking about a ferromagnet, a superconductor, the liquid gas transition, or a ferroelectric. These are the only important parameters. In general, such problems are very difficult to solve, and there's only one case where the critical exponents have been calculated analytically, and that was by Lars Onsager in 1944. He did it for the 2D square Ising model. An Ising spin is a spin that can only point in one of two directions, either up or down, constrained by the local chemical environment. And if you put such spins on a regular square lattice in two dimensions, Onsager could calculate the thermodynamic functions in the region of criticality exactly, and one gets this diverging behavior of the specific heat, which is replicated in a real material, cobalt, cesium, bromide. That's the easy case. In three dimensions, it's much harder and doesn't really yield to analytic solutions. But nevertheless, there are critical exponents describing quantities like shown here for both Heisenberg. These are continuous spins or Ising spins, and these exponents are good, as I said, across material scales. Well, then came Ken Wilson, who recognizing the importance of scale invariance for this class of problems, took some cues from renormalization group theory in high energy physics and applied it to condensed matter. And the basic idea of the renormalization group, for which he won the 1982 Nobel Prize, is that consider a system of spins, such as shown here, two-dimensional spins, and first solve the small problem of four spins, a block of spins that can then be replicated. Solve that exactly, and then split off the lowest energy manifold to describe now an effective spin. So if it's a spin a half, split off the two lowest states of this manifold. Now you have a new spin, and what you're saying is I'm only going to consider low energy physics. and solve that, then use that spin as the next spin in the next problem to solve, which is four blocks. Again, split off the lowest two and keep doing that. And ultimately, as part of that process, one extracts the critical exponents. And one can do that for a ferromagnet in any dimension. But ferromagnets are actually pretty simple. It doesn't really matter whether you have a ferromagnet in a piece of glop or a ferromagnet in a well-ordered crystal. You'll get a ferromagnet. But there's a class of materials, and really the largest class of magnetic materials, which are what's called antiferromagnetism. So I have to diverge a little bit more theory here, which is mean field theory, to describe antiferromagnetism. Basically, in considering the fundamental property of a material, which is the temperature at which it undergoes long-range order, then in mean field theory, you consider a single degree of freedom, and you ask, what's the effect of field placed on that spin, say, from its due to its neighbors? And you represent that field as a local magnetization with a coupling constant, and then you can, by assuming a standard form for the magnetization versus temperature and field, one can then stick the fundamental two-body interaction, make an approximation for magnetization, and using this approximation, and then one can then just turn the crank of statistical mechanics to extract an ordering temperature. We call this mean field ordering temperature the Weiss constant, and it's a very cheap and easy way to characterize the basic the microscopic elements of a correlated magnet. Z is the number of nearest neighbors. J is the exchange constant. That's ridiculous. Come on, this is a Mac, man. It should work. Okay, and S is the size of the spin. So in this way, one can calculate not only if the mean field ordering temperature, the expected ordering temperature of a ferromagnet, one can also calculate that of an antiferromagnet. And antiferromagnets are not so apparent because, as you can see, the spins cancel the field of the neighbors, and so you can't just, an antiferromagnet won't stick to your fridge. So it took Louis Nail to postulate that they existed, and for that he won the Nobel Prize in 1970. But the basic point I'm trying to make here is that antiferromagnetism sees the lattice. There's no need for this compatibility between the order print, between the ordered arrangement of spins and lattice. Antiferromagnets and ferromagnets are easy to distinguish in the lab. One measures the magnetization and then calculates from that the susceptibility. This can be, the magnetization can be measured in a commercial magnetometer. These are called squid magnetometers, and you just pull the sample through the very sensitive squid pickup coils, and you can measure the magnetization. You divide by the magnetic field and then plot the susceptibility, plot its inverse. And a ferromagnet, since a ferromagnet's susceptibility will diverge at its ordering temperature, 1 over chi goes to 0, and it has a positive intercept, an antiferromagnet will look like this with a negative intercept, and there you see right away you're able to determine the sign of the exchange from this, because the number of nearest neighbors and the spin are always positive. So this is an easy way to see whether you have an antiferromagnet or a ferromagnet. Now, there are a lot of antiferromagnets. I just, to sort of drive the point home, I copied one page out of John Goodenough's book, Magnetism and the Chemical Bond, and they sort of exist on a number of different, a variety of different lattices with different spin types and whatnot. But the point here is that it's hard to see, but this is the Weiss constant over the Nail temperature. So this is the energy, the temperature scale extracted from high temperature susceptibility divided by the real temperature at which it orders. And you can see almost all antiferromagnets have this ratio significantly greater than 1. So that's an indication that the ordering doesn't occur where you expected it. It occurs at a much lower temperature. So this is relatively common. Now, many systems, of course, don't order. For instance, glass is not ordered. One-dimensional systems don't order by virtue of fluctuations. Of course, systems that are, you know, where, that are below the percolation threshold don't have enough average interaction to order. And of course, you can kill order at high magnetic field. But I'm going to be talking about systems where the geometry of the lattice itself prevents the onset of long-range order. One can trace the basic ideas back to Gregory Vanier at Bell Labs, and he did the stat mech of an Ising a triangular lattice of Ising spins. If you think about it, it's going to be hard to find an ordered state because of this, right? It's, you can't simultaneously satisfy three antiferromagnetic bonds on a triangle. So he made the sort of the prescient statement that antiferromagnetism tries to exist in this non-fitting lattice. And it turns out that the really important point of this is not that it's hard to find a ground state, it's actually impossible to find a ground state, but that there are many different ways of finding the lowest energy a state. One can have this bond be happy, this bond be happy, or that bond be unhappy, and then that can be extended throughout the crystal. So this is just to drive the point home. This is the essence of geometrical frustration, whereas one can, on a square lattice, satisfy all the antiferromagnetic bonds. On a triangular lattice, you can't even do it on the basic plaquette by which you build up the lattice. But the real fundamental aspect of geometrical frustration is that there are multiple ways of doing this, and this leads to a thermodynamically large number of ground states for a real system. And in particular, Kadanoff block construction won't work because you can't even make the first approximation. So there's no hope of even applying renormalization group to solve any many-body property of this system. So it seems pretty hard at first sight. Well, Vanier had a large influence on Phil Anderson, and I actually ran into Phil a couple weeks ago and asked him about this. And Phil was just taken by this feature that you might find yourself with a set of degrees of freedom that just doesn't like the lattice it finds itself in, and he applied it in a very early paper to the question of atomic ordering in the spinel minerals where you can have the spinels are characterized by having this very sparse a lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra, and he realized that while it's possible to satisfy local constraints, it's impossible to satisfy them globally. Well, Phil worked on this idea. It sort of influenced a lot of his work in the subsequent decades. He applied. He's responsible for sort of identifying it as the fundamental aspect of spin glasses, and so all the theories of spin glass now incorporate both structural disorder and an element of frustration, and this is perhaps the poster child for that. Imagine your old square lattice, the fundamental plaquette. If you do something chemically to change one of these bonds to a ferromagnet, like maybe take an oxygen out in lanthanum cuprate, then you find yourself with a frustrated plaquette, but it's connected to chemical disorder, and that's the basis behind spin glass. In the 70s, he came up with the idea of a resonating valence bond, and this would be a type of insulator where the conduction electrons pair up in dimers, and they can resonate while at the same time not travel across the solid. And then finally, and perhaps most famously, he applied it to the problem of superconductivity in lanthanum cuprate, where the underlying state that he speculated, the underlying state that gives rise to pairing, the superconducting pairing is based on this resonating valence bond model. And the reason I mention this is that this is what got me interested in in this field, because I realized that he's describing a set of materials which don't really exist yet, or haven't. They might exist, but no one has really sort of talked about them. And I realized this back in 1990, and you can see a lot of other people realized it too right around then, but because it really took off. I should say that the difference for the, okay, now you're looking at the data and trying to understand. The difference here, 1990 is when the ISI started recognizing keywords. So there's always a jump in anything related to keywords around 1990. But so one assumes that the real data go like this. And I'll show you, hope to show you at the end that this will is about for, about poised for another big takeoff. Now, what's the bulk signature of geometrical frustration? It's basically, I mentioned that you start with an antiferromagnet and it doesn't order, so you expect to see something that in the inverse susceptibility that just extends well below the vise temperature. And in fact, that's what we see. Here I put on the sort of composite plot a set of materials with a very large range of interaction energies, ranging from 10 degrees on up to 500 degrees. Some are three-dimensional, some are two-dimensional. Here I've scaled both 1 over chi and temperature so that everything is 1. And you can see that there's a canonical behavior that basically they just sail right through the mean field ordering temperature and either develop ferromagnetic fluctuations or antiferromagnetic fluctuations. And early on, I made a list of these, and noticed that there were two basic properties that this class of materials that showed that behavior had. One is that they were all based on triangles. All of these lattices are triangle based, and two is that they all had isotropic spins, and that was important. Because I thought that was important initially, because I thought it was basically if you have some anisotropy, then you might have a tendency to develop order in one direction, might be biased. But this class of materials is restricted to materials where the vise constant over the ordering temperature is greater than 10, and that's because you can understand systems up to about where this is about 5 or 8. By developing theories which include multiple sublattices. That basically breaks down in a big way after you get up to 10, and this was shown by Anderson and also Tahar and Lines. So this is the region where mean field theory, where all bets are off for describing the physics in terms of mean field theory. Okay. Now, ordering is necessary but not sufficient for geometrical frustration. I mentioned this disorder, the degeneracy in the states. Here's and now I'm going to go into a series of materials where I kind of flesh out some of the ideas. This is a material, strontium, chromium, gallium-3, oxygen-19. It's basically a Kagame lattice. Let's see if I have a picture of a Kagame lattice. This is a lattice. It's drawn in a funny way, but imagine that the triangles are drawn where there's no line. Then you'll have a set of corner-sharing triangles in two dimensions, and you can see here that this material has a vise constant, a really well-developed vise constant of 500 degrees, but it doesn't order at all, as far as we can tell. And here down at about below 10 degrees, we have developed a large part of its residual entropy. Just to put this in perspective, if this had ordered at 500 degrees, it would have a specific heat. Here I'm showing the specific heat over T, which is the entropy. It would have a specific heat that would be equal to the dotted line here. So this is a huge amount of degeneracy in the system pushed down to an arbitrarily low energy scale. Neutron scattering has been done on this quite a while ago, and showing that even at the lowest temperatures, the correlation length never gets greater than about 7 angstroms, which is just 2 lattice constants. Now, the thing I forgot to mention here was this really well-developed T-square law. For Goldstone modes, like magnons, the heat capacity goes like T to the D over nu, where D is the dimensionality and nu is the exponent in the dispersion relationship. So in two-dimensional antiferromagnetic magnons, you expect T squared. And so this is sort of a conundrum because we see this well-developed T squared law, but we see no evidence for long-range order. Now, one can quantify how well developed those excitations are if you consider that you have a finite size of your material. Say this material is a powder, but assume there's something going on inside that restricts the development of the magnons to a finite size, say L, then the dispersion relation will be cut off at 1 over L, and then you can plug this into the statistical mechanics and estimate what size of what the heat capacity would be at low temperatures what size of the gap you would have if the dispersion were cut off. And if you had 100 angstrom sized particle, then it would be cut off down here. If you had 200 angstroms, it would be here. And what we can say is that the data for this material are basically limited to above these modes have an extension of greater than 500 angstroms, which is, for all intents and purposes, infinite. So these are really well-developed modes of some sort in a material for which we have no fundamental idea of the basic order. A hint for what's happening comes from field-dependent heat capacity. Basically, there is none. The low temperature heat capacity, these are just two different samples, two different concentrations of chromium, show very little field dependence at an energy scale where the Zeeman energy is essentially of order of this thermal energy. The fact that there's no field dependence is an indication that whatever these modes are, they're built out of singlets formed at a much higher energy. Yet they're still fluctuating at these temperatures. So there's still no good understanding for what these modes are, and it's kind of, you know, one of the outstanding problems. Many people simply say, well, it's a spin liquid, but that's it's not really sufficient. I mentioned the role of degeneracy. I just want to flesh that out a little bit. The type of lattice is extremely important, as I mentioned. It's not only the symmetry being triangular at the fundamental level, but also the connectivity. For instance, one can form a long-range ordered state in two dimensions, the so-called 120-degree state, which describes the angle between spins on a triangle, if one has atoms that like to live where the spins like to live in the plane. You set up a state on one plaquette, and then with the next plaquette, it's clear where to put the next spin, and on. So it's a really well-developed non-degenerate state. But if you try to do it on the Kagame lattice, what you find is you can do it on one triangle, but then because the next triangle is basically has no additional information, there are two ways of constructing the 120-degree state, and on. So this is a type of degeneracy which grows exponentially with the size of the system, and so connectivity is a very important part of this. This gives rise to modes that can exist in the lowest temperature state. Some of these modes are called weather vane modes because you can have, even in the lowest energy state, you can set up modes that have absolutely no energy, but the spins are sort of rotating around. I'll come back to these a little bit later, but it's sort of an indication of the unusual type of modes that one can that can occur in the frustrated materials. Now I want to describe, I just described a two-dimensional material. I want to describe a three-dimensional material, gadolinium gallium garnet. This is the gadolinium. This right here is the unit cell for the gadolinium. So I've left out the other atoms. You can get the idea. It's a pretty complex unit cell. This is also called the Hyperkagame lattice, in honor of its being corner-sharing triangles but embedded in three dimensions. If you measure the heat capacity of this, that's some experimental artifact, but you'll see basically very broad, featureless hump at low temperatures. But if you start putting and I should say this has an anti-ferromagnetic device temperature, if you start ramping the field up, then you find a peak developing, 0.9 Tesla, 1.3, and then you kill it, of course. But the point is that this is the phase diagram that results. And if you think about it, what you've done here is you've created an ordered state, most likely an antiferromagnet, with by application of a uniform magnetic field, and that's an indication of the unusual interplay of frustration with external field. Now, I just want to draw your attention to this upturn here, because it has, and these are measurements done by my former postdoc, Peter Schiffer, that this upturn is very unusual, but it bears a resemblance to a similar upturn seen in helium-3 at the solid to liquid interface. And this is related to the loss of the of a transverse mode in going from the liquid to the solid, yet retaining a very high entropy. This is a pretty good just by virtue of analogy indication of the of what we might call a classical spin liquid down here in gadolinium gallium garnet. Now I want to describe ice, and that's the reason for the iceberg. Ice and spin ice. The ice is a very unusual material, as was pointed out by Linus Pauling a long time ago in the mid-30s. In ice, what's in your freezer is a single crystal of oxygen, but the hydrogens are completely disordered. And so when people talk about ice models, they talk about degrees of freedom that exist on an ordered lattice but are disordered at zero temperature. And Pauling realized that the protons were disordered, the hydrogens were disordered, by comparing heat capacity and optical data at room temperature, and this is the basic what's known as the ice rule for ice, which is that around every oxygen, one can think of there being a fictitious tetrahedra. An irregular tetrahedra of four hydrogens, two of which are close to the oxygen and two of which are away. Of course, another way of saying this is that that's just the orientation of the O2 of the H2O molecule. But there are many ways of doing this on each tetrahedra, and this problem maps as was, I think, Anderson realized it, but more recently Harris and Bramwell realized that this problem maps onto Ising spins on either the B spinel or pyrochlore lattice, where the Ising axis is not uniaxial with all the spins, but rather points between the vertex and the center of the tetrahedron. So there's just a mathematical mapping between these two systems. Now the systems I'm going to be talking about are rare earth ions such as dysprosium. And in rare earths, the dominant spin interaction energy is dipole-dipole. And if you just work out the dipole-dipole interaction from Jackson, what you will find is that the energy of two spins with the angle that is given you by a tetrahedron for this Ising axis is where one spin is in and one spin is out is less than two out or two in. And what this means is that there are six states, the six states that dictated the positions of hydrogen and ice become these six spin states, two in, two out, and these are the ice rules for Ising spins on a tetrahedron. Now, where is this leading? There's this materials family, rare earth, which these are the magnetic ions, titanium-207, and these have inverse susceptibilities that are kind of all over the map. And because this interaction is fundamentally more ferromagnetic than antiferromagnetic, what we're going to do is focus on dysprosium, which you would say a priori doesn't look like it's frustrated, but I think I've already convinced you that the important thing for frustration is the degeneracy of the ground state. But if you look at the heat capacities of all of these guys, most of them undergo long range order, so they're kind of not interesting because that's a solved problem. But if you look closely at dysprosium, you notice that it's got this very very broad hump, similar to the GGG that I showed. So here's that broad hump. It's broad because the width is much larger than the centroid. And if you integrate up the entropy of dysprosium titanate, you find you don't get the full R log 2 of the ground state multiplet, but you get a number that's basically equal to Pauling's zero-point disorder. You can easily calculate this, and I show this here. The slides will be downloaded, so you can go through this calculation. It's very very simple, but this is an indication that we have a state called spin ice with a lot of zero-point entropy. Of course, ice has many phases, and so does spin ice. One can put, this is a powder sample, so we're seeing a lot of different ordering patterns in one, but if you put a field on dysprosium titanate, you can see order developing, and this has been the subject of several papers detailing the interaction of the field with the ordered states. Now, the subject of spin ice has come back recently with the realization that a single spin flip in spin ice can be described in terms of the creation of two magnetic monopoles. And it's a very very basic idea in solid state physics. It's called fractionalization, and the idea is that if say this is a canonical spin ice state, flip one of the spins. Say here, flip the spin, and then you've broken you've broken the ice rule on two neighboring tetrahedra. Okay, but now that you put energy into the system, so you've broken two ice rules. Now you can satisfy this tetrahedra, by restoring the ice rules here and breaking it here. And what you've done is you've taken an elementary spin flip in the system and separated it into two regions that are unhappy. And the math of this maps on completely to Dirac's monopole theory, which is also in Jackson. And these have actually been observed in neutron scattering, or at least the manifestation of this. If you have two monopoles separating, that what they will do is create a flux tube, a string of overturned spins, and this is basically what's been measured here. These are neutron scattering data from Morris in Science last year, and these are simulations of random walks of overturned spins with a bias put on them so that they create flux tubes, and you can see here the emergence of features that look sort of elongated as in these simulations. So this is a good way for particle physicists or string theorists who want a real system to study. One can look in I think even Stephen's lab or John's lab. There's probably strings and particles. So we've described a system which if it's going to have any kind of relevance beyond magnetism, one needs to broaden the language. And so far I've been discussing magnetic transitions that are ordered to disorder transitions. There's a type of transition in solids that is displacive. In other words, you have order above the transition, and you also have order below the transition. And what defines this transition, this is typically what happens when a material goes from, say, cubic to tetragonal, is that this can be described as a lattice mode of the system that goes to zero, whose energy goes to zero at a specific k vector that characterizes the different symmetries here. This is called a soft mode transition. So can we frustrate a soft mode? This is the idea. This is one way to do it. Imagine you have a hexagonal lattice of sticks, and you remove sticks in a periodic way. So this sounds similar to a frustrated, geometrically frustrated lattice. Then if you imagine what the soft mode for this system might be, you'll see pretty soon that you can't really have a soft mode where this gap goes to zero, because then you'd be tiling two space with pentagons. You can't do that. So this is a structural constraint that that's similar to trying to pack tetrahedra in three dimensions that just can't be accommodated. And this came to thinking about this through this material zirconium tungstate state. This is a picture of its unit cell. This is 128 atoms, because this has some of the features that we've seen in the frustrated magnets. It has degrees of freedom, namely these tungsten oxygen tetrahedra, which are untethered at one of their vertices. So it's sparse in a way that the Kagame lattice is sparse. The important thing about this material is that it has a thermal expansion which is negative over a very large range of temperature, and it's as negative as some of the largest ceramic positive thermal expansion materials. So it's technologically an important material. Now, negative thermal expansion is not that unusual. You can see negative thermal expansion in a rubber band, and it has a simple entropic explanation. But in three dimensions, it's very unusual. So this is just sort of an advertisement for the applied physicists. One can take this material and solve an important problem, which was there's a type of optical switch called the Fibre-Bragg grating, which has a temperature dependence of its index of refraction, which is undesirable if you want to deploy this in various hot and cold places. But you can totally eliminate this by bonding it to a piece of zirconium tungstate mixed with zirconium oxide that has the right value of negative thermal expansion that compensates for that temperature-dependent index of refraction. So this is a good example of the use of such materials. I will skip this connection to magnetism because it's for the thermodynamics aficionados. And I'll also skip this. Now, because we thought that there might be a connection to frustration, we did some measurements, namely heat capacity and neutron scattering, and showed that there was indeed a very large amount of entropy or low-lying degrees of freedom when you think that this is a very hard material with a Debye constant of several hundred. These are mode. This is heat capacity over T cubed, and this is neutron scattering, which is basically showing a large density of states down at energies of around 5 MeV, which is about 40-50 K. And this density of states can be modeled with typical thermal expansion modeling Grüneisen parameter to reproduce the negative thermal expansion. So this shows the importance of this density of states for real property at room temperature. We've done some other work on this showing that basically coming up with a two-dimensional toy model to explain that. Now, I'm going to talk, one last topic is frustration and magnetoelectricity. One can ask how might other degrees of freedom that are not magnetic couple to frustrated materials? And as I said, most antiferromagnets have some degree of frustration. They're not strongly frustrated like the ones I've described. And this might be a good way to think about coupling to electronic degrees of freedom. Now, one way that a geometrically frustrated magnet might order is to develop an incommensurate order parameter, which is an order parameter, a modulation of the spins, which has a wavelength that's an irrational fraction of the lattice. That's called an incommensurate state. Oh, I was going to say. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, there's a large interest in magnetoelectric materials from an applied point of view. People talk about optical lattices and ways to modulate the Kerr effect, but also in spintronics, one wants to be able to control magnetism with or the spin with an electric field, because that's what you can switch fast. So this is the underlying reason for looking at magnetoelectric materials. But the basic idea behind magnetoelectrics, or multiferroics is another name they go by, is that one wants to take a magnetically disordered material and order it, at the same time shift the atoms around to create a lack of inversion symmetry. That's what's required for ferroelectricity. So one can get both. What one really wants is simultaneously ferromagnetism and ferroelectricity. You might think, well, I will just go ahead and make a material using say a PLD apparatus like John showed me today, and just put down a layer of magnet and ferromagnet and ferroelectric, and that can work to some extent, but the effects that one expects are small because they're not intimately connected on the atomic scale. Nature has kind of dealt us not a strong hand to play, because there's no sort of great generic intrinsic multiferroic. So we have to look at mineral types that combine ferroelectric and ferromagnetic ions, and just by sort of combinatorial chance, these are hard to find. But there are a few. So I'll describe that. And the connection to incommensurate states that I mentioned before was that one imagines that for an incommensurate order, inversion symmetry is just going to be broken for free. So sorry, that was out of order. So here's an example, since we were drawn to this by looking at interesting triangle-based systems, here's a Kagame material, but which has a corrugation in the nickel lattice. We call this a Kagame staircase. This material has a complex set of transitions, four transitions, and an incommensurate ground state that has this phase diagram here. This is the paramagnetic phase, the high temperature incommensurate and low temperature incommensurate. And it turns out that this phase is also ferroelectric. And so one can understand this in terms of a simple Landau theory. And again, it's the basic idea is that the magnetism breaks the center of inversion symmetry, giving rise to a ferroelectric. Now, I'm just about done, which will leave time for questions, hopefully. You can see where this is going. You know, we've connected frustrated magnetism to thermal expansion properties and to trap, to non-mobile charge. Now we're going to ask how does this tie to itinerant charge? And this is where the end of my own research comes, but where I can see the future of frustrated magnetism. The poster child for this is lithium vanadate. This is a spinel material where the vanadium ions lie on this spinel, or it's also called the pyrochlore lattice. And this has this is a metal, data taken by Hide Takagi, and it has a very large heat capacity. This is a heat capacity eventually at low temperature. It's relatively temperature independent, which implies that, since it's metallic, it implies that the electrons have a heavy mass, which is about 300 or 400 times the bare mass of the electron. And one thinks that this must have something to do with frustration. The key thing here is that there are only two in this lattice type. There are only two oxides among the 3D elements that are conducting, which is this guy and lithium titanate, which is a superconductor. So this is a fairly rare effect, and when you think about it, it's basically a statement that we're kind of stuck with spherical harmonics to describe the orbitals in atoms. And so the problem is one of putting a spherical harmonic on a triangular lattice. Again, it doesn't fit, and so that's that's most likely what's behind the paucity of metals among triangle-based 3D elements. 3D meaning the sort of the iron, chromium, manganese series. So I just want to make a final advertisement for the importance of frustrated systems for new physics. And I hear from John that you've had some speakers talk about topological insulators. And this is a topic that's really growing in importance right now. And the idea is that there are some insulators out there which are insulating for really interesting reasons, not just because the bands are, not just because we have a big band gap, but because there's a fundamental symmetry inside the material, which has to do with the structure of the material and also the influence of spin orbit coupling. Leon Balance's group has discussed the importance of frustrated lattices such as the pyrochlor lattice for creating what he calls band touching, and this is another example. What he shows here is that band touching or flat bands is basically what I talked about earlier. It comes from the same source as the degeneracy of these zero modes, these weather vane modes in the Kagame lattice. This is the same thing, and so one expects that strong correlations will also play a role in itinerant systems on frustrated lattices. And finally, this paper just came out last week by a group here in Canada. So raise the flag. What this group showed was that what they say is quite generically, whenever electrons hopping on the pyrochlor lattice acquire a band gap from spin orbit, the resulting state is either a strong topological insulator or a weak topological insulator. So this is why I think the field of frustration and frustrated lattices is sort of alive and kicking and will probably take on greater importance in the next few years. Now, so just to summarize, I think I've shown that geometrical frustration is a paradigm for strongly correlated matter. And that emergent states can come out of a system where the mean field states are suppressed, and that can lead to novel excitations, monopoles, and Dirac strings, and unique responses to external perturbations that lead to negative thermal expansion, magnetoelectrics, and a possible route to topological insulators. Now, this I've collaborated with a lot of people on this work. This is just the names I could remember. And these are most of the people. I remember everyone. So thank you.